This stock and commodity report is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office, so no update at the commodity markets on this day. We do have a really good update of the program that took place in 2015 at the Bloomington Normal Marriott Hotel for the Farm Assets Conference today. We'll hear from Bruce Sherrick about land values.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
Let me take a moment as we get started for this day to remind you about some of our online programming and how you may use it over time. As you know, since 2003, University of Illinois and WILL have been posting Commodity Week as a podcast. It may be one of the very oldest podcasts on the planet. We're very proud of that. You can always pick it up and all the rest of our programming online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can look in the podcast section, or if you prefer and you just happen to use iTunes, search for either Closing Market Report or Commodity Week. You may be even able to search for my name, Todd Gleason, and you'll find the podcast there. You can listen to these programs online on your computer, on your phone, whether it's an Android and or a iPhone or other device that can connect to the internet of any type, including your iPad and other kinds of pads. So make sure you visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. All of our agricultural programming is posted to the content sections there not long after it airs on our radio stations. It's just part of the service that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. We've been putting this program together in its current iteration since 1985. It's all about farm broadcasting, commodities, and commodity prices, along with weather. So pick it up right there at willag.org. Again, the web address, willag.org. Do it right now. Do it online. Do it on your own convenience. For this 1 week, we'll add a regular feature to the Closing Market Report. We call it Trading Terms. Our term for the day is speculate. Speculation is the practice of engaging in risky financial transactions in an attempt to profit from short or medium-term fluctuations in the market value of a tradable good, rather than attempting to profit from the underlying attributes embodied in the instrument. Many speculators pay little attention to the fundamental value of a security or a commodity and instead focus purely on price movements. Speculation can, in principle, involve any tradable good or financial instrument. Speculators are particularly common in the market for stocks, bonds, commodity futures, currencies, fine art, collectibles, real estate, and derivatives. Speculators play one of four primary roles in financial markets, along with hedgers who engage in transactions to offset some other pre-existing risk, arbitrageurs who seek to profit from situations where fungible instruments trade at different prices in different market segments, and investors who seek profit through long-term ownership of instruments' underlying attributes. The role of speculators is to absorb excess risk that other participants do not want, and to provide liquidity in the marketplace by buying or selling when no participants from other categories are available. Successful speculation entails collecting an adequate level of monetary compensation in return for providing immediate liquidity and assuming additional risk so that, over time, the inevitable losses are offset by larger profits. And that's the definition of speculation.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office on this Friday afternoon. So no updates of the commodity markets, trade, or policy. But we will take a look at land values from the Farm Assets Conference that took place the 24th day of November of 2015. That was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Bruce Sherrick is the director of the Center for Farmland Research on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. He made this presentation.
The CIFF, Center for Farmland Research, is a really interesting unit at the University of Illinois. We in our department have a history going back at least to the early 1900s, before the beginning of the building, in fact, about doing research in farmland values. We are part of the process that helps set independently valuation numbers that result in assessment for farmland in Illinois. There's been a change in the law. If we want to talk about that later in Q&A, perhaps we can. And we do a lot of other things that track farmland values and support institutions that are interested in farmland values. So our tagline is improve the accuracy and understanding of the asset class and provide unbiased research and useful tools for those involved with farmland investments. We want to advance farmland markets through research and information. That's it. We don't have a side to take. We're not promoting TIA. We're not against it. We're not sort of in a position of doing anything except providing a constant and forever forward-looking group of folks interested in doing farmland research. So that's been really fun. We've started building it out. We've hired two new faculty members. And what's really interesting is the most recent addition, the title of this person's faculty appointment at the University of Illinois is Big Data in Agriculture. So think about that given the things we started with in the conference and kind of what we're hearing throughout the day. What we're going to do in the next few minutes is go through a little bit of historic context. And I always like to level set on this one because people forget how big the asset class is and how local it is and how small it is. People forget how gigantic the sector is and how complicated it is to make an investment in this giant sector. So I want to do a little bit of work on that, how to think about establishing value, because it's one thing to look at the value of something that sold. What I think we're actually asking about is the value of things that didn't sell. And unlike a share of Nike, if you buy or sell a share of Nike, I know what every other share of Nike is worth. If I buy this farm, I don't necessarily know everything about what the neighboring farm is worth. Unlike residential real estate, where we have good hedonic models and we can kind of adjust for the characteristics or they turn over frequently enough, neighborhood effects, we can estimate this. We don't have either a central place for listing all farmland nor an explanation for why it all sold. About half, this is a punchline I'll return to later, about half of the land transfers involve land not sold at arm's length, transferred in estate, settlement, or otherwise between related parties. So again, it's difficult to use something as simple as the transfer price to really say what is the value of the farmland that didn't sell. 1% sells per year at arm's length, we get good indicators. The characteristics, though, are not random. We don't just sell it based on dropping flower petals out of a high-flying airplane. I also want to talk about some of the issues that I think are affecting the value to 2016 and beyond. Now, I don't know the pace at which the big data companies, several of which were in the room and outside, I don't know the pace at which they're changing agriculture, but I am pretty sure they are. Excuse me, that they are changing agriculture. I think 15 years ago, if I said, I do a lot of meetings and I move around the country quite a bit, and if I were to say I'm in Minneapolis next week, most of you would have assumed I had to go someplace to pick up an airline ticket. When was the last time you drove somewhere to pick up an airline ticket? Okay. So the internet did to travel agencies what big data is doing to certain parts of the technology of delivering information and decisions to agriculture. It's just rendering certain things truly, truly obsolete. You can now get soils maps for free everywhere. You can now get weather information from lots of sources, different levels of quality. We'll eventually sort out how to put that together. I also want to talk very briefly about world demand, because I think that influences farmland values. The long-term thesis is pretty clear to me, but in the short term, it doesn't mean much. But I think the long-term thesis is pretty clear. And then look at some other things that are especially important as we move forward in the next couple of years,
as we try to unwind this big monetary policy experiment we started in September of 2008. That will leave us negative 18 minutes for discussion. And these numbers I know aren't easily seen from the distance you sit, but you can always email me or we'll make these slides available if you're interested. But what's important is the far right-hand column. Far right-hand column shows that the sector is worth about $3 trillion now. $2.5 trillion of that is in real estate. That's an enormous concentration. Pick another manufacturing sector. That's what we are, by the way. Pick another manufacturing sector with 85%+ of its assets in one category. It's very difficult to find, right? And if you look at the growth through time, so the left-hand panel is decades, the right-hand panel is the last 3 years, the vertical and dotted line separates those. You can see the growth in asset values has been astronomical. The next picture will show this as well. The debt has not grown proportionally. This is also critical, and as we make comparisons to the 80s, and the argument I'll make very strongly, frankly, that I don't think we, I have in my mind this bubble with a big red circle and a line through it. Since 6 years ago now when the Fed had their conference on the farmland bubble, and we've been waiting for it to be a bubble, we've provided, at least from the research side, a very similar story all the way through. We don't see the forces setting up for anything like a classic bubble, and I'll say why later. But the debt-to-equity and the debt-to-asset ratios are incredibly small. In the sector in total, we have only 10.9% debt. If you put all the companies together on the S&P 500, collapse their balance sheets onto one single entity, it'd be between 65 and 66% debt. Think about that for a moment. Yeah? So some pictures of that same information. Non-real estate has grown steadily. Real estate has grown more rapidly. The total assets follow the farmland value side. So we're really having, it's not a tail wagging a dog. It's a tail with four legs. I mean, this is the part of the market that actually matters. The summaries of these farmland, more than 80%. No matter how you slice it, of farm assets, very low real estate debt. So if you had 80% of the assets in real estate, wouldn't you expect 80% of the debt in the sector to also be underneath mortgage, real estate? No. Unfortunately, that's not sort of rationally levered in that sense. And growth rates, assets have grown at about a 5.4%. How many of you would put your money in a CD at 5.4% right now? Real estate slightly higher than that because the non-real estate grown less quickly and debt has actually declined. Grown in aggregate, declined as a percentage. The next bullet point I think is really critical to understand because this is, if anything, the comment that's equivalent to if you were in 1980 and you wanted to invest in a travel agency, this is the one thing you really want to worry about. Okay? There's no equity market in agriculture. I can't go buy $5,000 worth of farmland. It doesn't mean anything. There's no for sale units that size. We don't have access to that sector yet. So that describes the reasons for why the financial structure above, very low debt, very high asset leverage, so on, is what it is. But it's really important, and we're experiencing now early stage financialization. Early stage financialization. Okay, farmland prices, everybody blink a couple of times, get ready to hold your eyes open. This is also in case you were just getting really bored and dozing off. I'm going to go through the same six slides I always go through, but I update them once a year. There were 6,000. I just saved myself 6,000 words. Okay. What do you notice is that the land market is about the same wherever you look at it. Those are just rolling through the states. And if I had, instead of dollars on the left-hand axis and time on the bottom, used bushels of corn on the left-hand axis, the pictures would have been even more stable. Farmland is what it earns. It's a quote I'd like to attribute to Dale Opperle or Yogi Berra or somebody more famous than me, but it is really truly the case that farmland is what it earns. The productive capacity is a very good proxy for what it can earn. On top of that, the developmental pressures are in a sense, a separate layer of value, if you will. But this is a really remarkable feature that wherever we look, we get a very similar picture. And in Illinois, we have a lot of really good data resources. It's fantastic. You're in the middle of one of the places we can do more with good data and good research than any other place. But it gives us some confidence in extracting and thinking about these issues in a little broader context that this relationship is so stable. So how's farmland done? Again, these numbers are very difficult, except perhaps for the front few rows of tables to see. But farmland has dominated almost every other asset class we can identify. If you go to our website, one of our websites, we have three, we're going to try to collapse them a bit. But the farmland.illinois.edu, we have a lot of the data in tools and in spreadsheets. You can just download and make your own pictures out of these, beautify them, send them back to me. But we have compared it to about 60 other asset classes. So equities, other financials, fixed income, REITs, mortgage REITs, other ways you can take your dollars and invest them in something. And farmland's performance has been remarkable. So I only brought 91 through 2014 in this table because people want to say, oh, you picked the best time period. Well, in fact, the story doesn't change much. If we go clear back prior to the 80s till now, it doesn't change much. If we do the last decade, it's even more positive. So a two-decade period is kind of a modern agriculture period. A third of it has ethanol, a third of it doesn't. But it's a nice period of time because in the equities, part of it was dot-com pre and post. In the financials, part of it was monetary policy stabilization and easing, part of it was not. So there's sort of two epochs in all the major financials. And some things I'd like to point out. Farmland, the first column annual return, has been as high as anything. The NCREIF indexes are professionally managed farmland. I want to point out that USDA collects information on everybody, including the kind of farm I grew up on, which was one of our farms, a small experimental, had Smucker's contracts from Oroville, Ohio, and guineas and chickens and pigs and turkey. We grew everything. So I put myself through college with sweet corn. So those farms are in this data set along with the large commercial scale ones that Todd talked about earlier, the ones that actually grow the food that we eat. So if you look at just professionally managed, it's even been better. If you look by region, that's what's at the top. And on the right-hand column, what's really critical is the correlation with farmland. Correlation with farmland and farmland is, of course, one, but professionally managed farmland does track the total, but not quite as variable. And what's astounding is that farmland is at a negative correlation with inflation, no matter what time period you examine, positive correlation with inflation and a negative correlation with equities. So financial equities, negative correlation, positive, no matter how you slice it. So part of the answer to what will farmland do in 2016 depends on what we do with inflation in 2016. If we successfully unwind the Fed's balance sheet without great inflation, that's one story. If we have a lot of inflation, farmland tends to follow that up in nominal values. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. The definition of inflation, the nominal change in the value of a commodity, what's more of a commodity-producing asset than farmland? Okay, now here's a picture that I love. It takes a minute to explain. Since I said 1991 to 2014 was just one sample period, people will say, what about other sample periods? And instead of polling you each and saying, which period of time do you want to look at? I just said, let's look at all of them. Okay? So every year we update this graph as well. Down the vertical axis on the left is the date you bought it. Across the top is the date you sold it. So if you look at the top right-hand corner, the color is normalized on its long-term average. So that top right corner said 10.41 like the previous slide. The green is higher, the red is lower. If you bought and sold each year, you get the horizontal diagonal stair steps that say the 1 year rates of return on this graph are buy it and then sell it, buy it and then sell it, buy it and then sell it. It's important because the investment community likes to look at rolling 1 year period rates of return to compare to other alternatives. Farmers like to say, what's three generations of my family likely to experience? They're in that top right-hand corner, okay? Somewhere in between is how you actually ought to think about this problem. And think about 20 years from now when this graph still exists, but maybe I don't, and some way taking a viewfinder and looking at any particular period you'd like on that graph, what do you know about farmland? Well, here's something that I'll assert. It's a much more stable rate of return than the production value of its income might suggest it should be. Farmland markets don't move as quickly as the income underneath them does. Very much like our estimates of climate don't change just because we experience different weather. 2012 happened, we don't think every year is going to be a drought now. Well, farmers do, but. Or we have a very rainy week, we don't think it's always going to be a rainy week. Well, income happens, and we don't think that's the only thing that can ever happen to farmland. You've seen the little bumper stickers, something happens, why would we say income happens, right? Okay, so the interesting picture in the insert, though, it's normalized on zero. And how many times do we have a red dot sticking down through it? Once. So in that entire period of time, how many negatives did we have? Once, and it was in the 80s, meaningfully. I mean, there are little dips, there are positives, and there are local market conditions that are always up and down. You also don't see many horizontal stripes or many vertical stripes. That's important because if you see horizontal or vertical stripes, the length of time it takes you to undo a mistake is longer. The length of time you benefit from an accidental positive buy-in opportunity is also longer. Both sides of that coin when you see stripes. What do we know about risk? And I'll go through this one more quickly. The quicker this cables in to a constant, the more we know about risk. In other words, our estimate of the variability gets better as we have data. That's all I'll leave on that one, because there's the S&P by contrast. Now it looks like, you know, a bat signal. It's got points and negatives and ups and downs, and the horizontal and vertical stripes are big. So if you happen to buy at the right time, you can brag about what a good investor you are. If you happen to get in at the wrong time, well, you know, that dot-com bubble got me. But there are long terms, and it matters when you got in and when you got out, much more so than in fixed income style investing. What do we know about the risk? Well, S&P 500, the risk even changes through time. The risk even changes through time, okay? So again, this is just some, you know, structural differences before we get into some more drivers. This is one that you can regenerate on the fly if you wish, about 60 different categories from a tool at our website. But this just, again, is the low equity correlation, positive CPI and inflation effects. This helps explain why the pension funds and institutional investors are really interested in the asset class. Long duration matches up with their obligation side of their business, long positively correlated with inflation, and provides a diversifying effect. Now, there aren't enough of them yet to really move the needle, but that's where they are. But let's talk a little more about that institutional investor, because again, we get a lot of calls because of our nameplate. People assume that we're more affiliated with TIA than we are. We love what they do, by the way. They have a really well-developed institutional platform. They're very responsible investors, and they're very careful about black eyes, and therefore their devotion to conservation practices, in fact, are some of the best you've ever seen. They can also do it on five continents. That's hard for individuals. So again, are they disrupting the farmland market? Can't find any evidence of that. Does a seller ever complain that I sold my land for too much? Hardly ever. Do they ever change operational practices? Only if they can find something better. But that's the story for every institutional investor we run into. They don't tend to have kind of slash and burn tactics in the U.S. But let's think a little more carefully. You know, there are 9 states in the U.S. where it's difficult for institutional investors to buy farmland. Iowa North, that sort of middle block. I forget, where was the largest decline in value? Oh yeah, Iowa, never mind. You guys don't think anything's funny. You're a tough audience. So, don't worry, the sports programs at Illinois will get better. So we have about $2.5 trillion in U.S. farm real estate. There's about $6 billion recorded in institutional ownership in NCREIF. I exclude from institutional ownership some big holders like the Mormon Church, foundations at universities, others who don't have the option to buy or sell. So I only want to talk about institutional investors that in fact can buy or sell in and out of a market. This matters because the fiduciary responsibility requires them to acquire more or distribute proceeds on an up and down. So that's about $3.5 billion in row crop, about 2.6 in permanent, and then the REITs that are getting more active. Many of you saw the Farmland Partners acquisition in East Central Illinois, very creative structure on that one, very interesting. From both sides on that. But the REITs are beginning to bubble up and develop some prominence. And I know personally 3 of them. There are about 5 notable privates that are doing something similar, but not yet making it into a publicly offered event. And that's about $1 billion, a little over $1 billion maybe. So suppose I'm off by a factor of 2. I usually am, right? My guesses can be off by a factor of 2. If so, that's still less than 1% of the aggregate value of real estate. So they're really moving the market. It's a little harder to tell.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
It's National Eggnog Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1809, Kit Carson was born, an American frontiersman. His last words when he died in 1868 were reportedly, "Wish I had time for just one more bowl of chili." 1826 marked an eggnog riot at West Point Military Academy. When informed that their Christmas eggnog would be alcohol-free, cadets in North Barrack No. 5 decided to make their own eggnog with alcohol. Of course, the party eventually got out of hand, and the artillery unit stationed at West Point had to quell the disturbance. In the aftermath, 6 cadets resigned, 19 were court-martialed, and many, including a young Jefferson Davis, were confined to quarters for more than a month. In 1914, John Muir died. Muir was a naturalist who was largely responsible for the establishment of the Yosemite National Park in California. Muir drew attention to the devastation of mountain meadows by sheep and cattle, leading to his role as father of the national park system. And in 2006, in the Chicago suburb of Villa Park, thieves stole a semi-tractor trailer filled with broccoli. It was valued at $50,000. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson. Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to Illinois Public Media on a Friday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we're hearing a portion of the presentation made by Bruce Sherrick, the director of the Center for Farmland Research at the University of Illinois.
So remember my analogy to the folks selling airline tickets? Commercial real estate was kind of at this stage 15 years ago before FIREA came, and it became a listed and acceptable asset for holdings in certain pension fund positions. Since then, what's happened on commercial real estate? It's moved entirely to this asset class and ownership, and not to much of the detriment of the owners. It's just thinking about taking your farms and adding them into a fund and getting that many dollars of the fund back, where you still own your farm, 1031 it, you get to keep your basis, die with it at an elevated basis, and so on. So it's not that structurally different. There's some different paperwork to do. So I think there's some possibility, and one of those is big data. So big data to me is not quite like, John Jansen's presentation I thought was fascinating, known him for a really long time, always enjoyed what they've done. I think Rodney is the first Rodney from Corn Growers is the first person I heard say that for the last 15 years, we've been 3 years away from cellulosic ethanol, right? So we've been really close to the edge of big data for a really long time, and I don't know what will trigger it, but some of them are possible and some of them may be happening. I think of big data as two things, higher resolution or higher frequency observations than we had before, and it displaces certain things. So we can now look from the sky. If you haven't done this yet, go to acrevalue.com and look up the value of your farmland. It's like a free appraisal report. Crop database, soils, weather for the last 5 years, distance to markets, lots of things that you would do in a normal appraisal. And again, it won't be right, but it also won't be wrong. And everybody's will kind of be like the thermometer that's shifted. It's not necessarily that this is the best estimate. It's a great technology, though, for getting a baseline. And you can look at changes in that through time and know something important. How do they do that? The same way John did that on his iPad in real time, processing petabytes of data at some remote server in the cloud. We're all carrying around in our pockets a computer that is effectively the same scale processing capacity as was used to launch the first spacecraft to the moon. So again, the scale of technology is changing really differently. And what this does is it lets us answer new questions that we didn't think about before. It answers older questions better and lets us to do it at really low cost. I can now figure out where to put seeds in a field based on genetics for almost nothing. It used to take a lot of work to get to that point. It's a really cool innovation. I can look from the sky and decide this field or this field, which one would be cheaper to rent, based on its agronomics and its distance to the rest of my locations. So again, I don't know when we'll get to the point of that being operational, convenient, you know, iPhone-like, that we all get the menu, but it's at least headed that way, and I think it changes the economics of the value of inputs, where now one of the important inputs is information. Okay, big data shows up in lots of ways. Everybody knows about Landsat, LiDAR, Sirgo data, crop data layer, weather. Weather's really good, by the way. Yield maps, fertility, conservation zones, many, many others. So think about where your questions can arise that they didn't happen before, and you can answer them all on the same platform. I love this little company called Planet Labs that's launching what they call Doves, these little 25-pound satellites in sun-synchronous orbit, so they can get a picture of every square foot of the U.S. every 17 hours or so. Clouds no longer matter. you get enough pictures that you can start to assemble this. And now I can use my DVI maps to say as much about why yields varied as you can use with your John Deere maps to say what yields were. I know where it rained. I know where the temperature was. I know what date it was planted and so on. So that's kind of the evolution of that. The big ones, some agronomic practices. You see, you know, fertility placement, genetic selection, field operations, logistics. This is actually a pretty big one. Think SAP for agriculture. Benchmarking and profitability analysis. These are things that I think change the structure of the question we ask relative to the 1980s. I don't have a mouse that's going to be very convenient for pointing at stuff on this screen, but I have in the middle of this the Big Data Climate Challenge and then the Big Data Summit, both held at the University of Illinois for several years now. What's interesting is they started out with computer applications, and this year they were half agricultural. We're at the center of one of the largest, it's one of the seven largest computing facilities in the world. We've run a big data conference for some time now, generated by engineering and data science folks. Now half of the program in the afternoon was agricultural. I think that's really cool. That's extremely cool. And we can look at things again from the sky in ways that just couldn't before. So what's it do? It reduces the cost of information, adds new things you have to manage. I just can't imagine, you know, handing the field view to my mom after my dad passed away and saying, manage the farm using this set of pictures. You know, it takes a while for that to be incorporated and adopted into the system of thinking, but it does change how we can make decisions. Okay? It also makes, the last one I think is especially critical. How many of you use flex cash leases, some form? Should be more hands go up on that. This is where they should head. It allows you to create more customized linkages between the inputs and the outcomes and what the split of the income the land can generate would be. So, big data players, I'll skip through this one for now and talk quickly about a couple of things that I think actually do impact land values going forward. So I've tried to study a little bit more in the last year the evolution of commercial real estate. And I'm on a board of a company that has offices in DC. And so I really use that as my case. And I know what we pay per square foot, and I know what we paid several years ago per square foot, and I know how we made the lease this last time, and I know what we're looking for next time. And I also looked at Dallas as another case where it used to be the case that if you wanted to acquire commercial real estate office space, you went to the place, you toured it with a realtor, you talked to the owners, and you negotiated on your leases one at a time. Now I go to a website, and I say my triple net equivalents are for this many square feet, with this many feet above the surface of the road, turns out to be important in certain towns. And I can, without ever going someplace, get all the information really, really quickly. It's really reduced the search cost. I think part of that is really important. And what we're starting to see in farmland markets, TIA has several billion dollars invested, but not a retail product. Much of it is ex-US. The REITs have maybe $1 billion, maybe a little more. But you build these private holdings. I was at a private equity conference last week, or 2 weeks ago now, where the interest in agricultural real estates was just off the chart. You know, $300 billion in the room devoted to alternative investments, and all of them were going, the problem is there's no ticker symbol for farmland. We can't make an investment that moves our needle. But what happens is you begin to, by putting the funds together, moving them toward things that are more standardizable, getting the scale big enough that if somebody buys or sells, you don't have to redeem a property. Nike doesn't have to do anything different because you bought or sold from somebody else. And you eventually move toward single-purpose, divisible, ETF-like structures that let you get to financialization in ag. I don't mean this is big or coming rapidly, but I think it's a really key signal. It's a great thing to think about the changing structure of ag, and I think big data speeds it up. So here's the pictures, though, that I want to talk about. So put all of that in place and think about, we had recently some really big crops after a couple of short crop years. 2012 was a great income year for many people, despite the fact that we had low outcomes and yields. So again, if you want to just track revenues or just track yields, it doesn't give you a good signal for income any more than commodity prices are a direct analog to that without the inverse price yield correlation has to be understood to do that. But we've had lower prices, which have put pressure on rental markets in particular, and we've built up some buffers. We have a lot better stocks around the world now. World demand indicators are still really positive, but scaling China back from 6.2 to 5.9% GDP growth is absolutely critical. That is a really important change in what we think is going to happen to world caloric demand. the rest of the world as the developing part of the world proxy for that. A great set of three maps. If you've never thought about it before, envision where the people are on the planet. Think of a map of where people live on the planet. So you have the Pacific Rim, Indonesia, Asia, India, Pakistan, and then the rest of us are kind of spread out. Look at where soils are in the world. Middle of the US, middle of South Africa, or middle of Africa, South America, part of the breadbasket, kind of Ukraine and north. Not much in China, good New Zealand, but it's tiny. None of those things move yet that I've talked about, right? And finally, where does water fall out of the sky or exist in the ground? So that's where things will be grown, and that's where people are going to eat. The difference of that is trade, and that story sort of sets up in the long term pretty well to increase movement toward areas as caloric demand increases because people quit eating rice and start feeding cereals to animals and eating animals. The calorie multiplication with income increases is really important, very stable around the world, and China going again from 6.2 to 5.9 impacts our future demand for those kind of products more than a lot of other things. Factor productivity. Gee, how much non-Roundup pesticides or herbicides do we use in certain crops now? We've really changed factor use. One of the factors we're going to use even more of is information. I'll talk about a couple of other things, though, because people will always say, yeah, but the pictures look like the 80s, because a lot of those stories were the same. Different players, big increase in demand. We found Russian, we're going to export grain forever. Or we found, you know, in the beginning of the 80s, we had some stories that sort of stacked up. But this is why I say it's not the 80s. I have about four or five slides in a row here. One, we now have crop insurance on everything that matters. That's meant to be an exaggeration so that it gets mistweeted and forwarded, and we get a lot of popular press on that. But virtually everything that matters, corn, soybeans, and wheat, everything else is rounding error, and we insure it all. And we insure it all at very high coverage and use revenue products. The policy debate a couple of weeks ago about cutting back on crop insurance was a pretty predictable bait and switch. Jonathan Kappas knew more about it before it happened than the senators who were going to vote, I believe. But we were going to threaten crop insurance because it's now the biggest title. It's bigger than Title I and bigger than the commodity title. We insure all the acres. Number two, let's look at debt ratios in the U.S. Remember I started with it's very, very low right now, and in fact, the lenders in the room, this is not a bad time perhaps to add fixed rate debt underneath your farmland. Maybe they haven't made enough loans. Their loss rates are way too low. Farm Credit's always nervous when I point that out, but it's hard to do research on what causes losses when there aren't any losses. But aggregate debt ratios have plummeted through time, not like the 80s. Farm operating debt interest rates have plummeted. Here's a great one, farm mortgage interest rates. I didn't update the last two quarters on this, but they look like a continuation of the last ones there. But what happened is if you find 1980s on that map, pre-1980s, we had about 175 basis points of credit risk cost in a farm mortgage note. After the crisis, we had about 225 basis points of risk cost in a farm mortgage. We got nominal rates up to almost 18%. And I'm going to use the example of suppose you had a 15% farm mortgage with a 40-year amortization on 80% LTV. I know this is possible because I have a copy of one. That required 12% of the cash flow of the 12% of the asset's value as cash flow just to pay for the debt. That's a lot, right? So now if you have a 50% LTV loan, you're kind of stretching it at maybe a 5% or lower, 2.5% on a 15-year AM, 2.5% real, if there's any growth rate in the value of the underlying or any income over top of it, you don't need that much to service the debt, right? And we get collateral penetration sooner. We get a buffer of equity in the product sooner. So I put this together and I say, does the land market make sense now? And here's a great picture. I have this one and the next one that have the same information. The following one after this is one we took from a Farm Doc Daily thing with Gary. This one is just looking at, through time, the Illinois rent-to-value ratio and the 10-year constant maturity treasury rate. This is important because when we talk about increasing interest rates, if the Fed can do that, I have a slide about that in a minute, doesn't really impact the middle of the yield curve nearly as much as the front end or the short part of the yield curve. So keep that in mind while we look at this. I'm not saying the 10-year CMT is the right discount rate, but it looks like a pretty good proxy for the real cap rate built into the markets. At least proxies, your eyeball test is that except for the 80s, it matched pretty well. But in the 80s, They're the characteristics that led to what I think of as a true classic bubble. So we didn't have crop insurance, we didn't have interest rate markets, and we did have some other things. So let's just say, suppose we were agnostic to this. I put a blindfold on, didn't tell you what the asset was, and said, here's the income profile, what will you pay me for this asset? Okay, so value investors look across the S&P and say, what's the income, what are the dividend yields, what will I pay for this asset? If we did that and said, what's my cost of money at a 10-year duration point, I come up with a red line is how much I think that land would be worth. Now in the 80s, that red line is far below the blue line, which is the actual value of farmland. Pretty astounding, isn't it? The 80s, you look at it and you go, wow, it's a classic bubble. What's happened in the last few years? The last few years, we've had income that's grown very, very rapidly. We have sort of total returns to farmland. They're really, really impressive. And yet farmland markets didn't increase in value as much as that would have suggested, saying that people got that it was temporary, at least to some degree. We're adjusting our climate expectations based on the weather we experience. We had 3 years of really good weather, maybe climate's getting better, right? So we adjust that way with farmland markets. The capitalized value in red, much higher than the blue line, much higher fundamental value if that was viewed as permanent and forever. So I don't see that this sets up as a bubble. Now here's a graph that'll really blow your mind. If you take the yield curve every day from 2001 till present, so the front surface of that, the bottom right front curve is the yield curve. And if I'll try to point at this to try to make a little more sense. So through time, if we just plotted the yield curve from 2001 through today, and today the yield on a one-year maturity is 0, 3 month, effectively 0, 6 month, and so on, out to a 30-year point on the yield curve. And I just want to look at the history of that and ask myself, what do I actually know about or think about interest rate markets? My sheer face wall, September 19, 2008 point is when the Monday after the week where Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy and the Friday with the short-term markets kind of shut down. The next day, we started announcing quantitative easing programs and buyouts that led to a gigantic Fed balance sheet, and we have a lot of pressure for liquidity at the short end of the yield curve. I know that's lots of words really fast, but what it means is there's a ton of excess liquidity at the short end of the yield curve. The government instituted a couple of extra programs. The little ripples along the front are QE1, QE2, Operation Twist. I forgot TARP and TAL for the first one. QE1, QE2, Operation Twist, and then the easing where they were buying back bonds. Dumping money on the yield curve to try to draw the long-term end down, eventually have to take the bottom back up, and the arguments about can we raise interest rates really only apply to the front sort of slice or the yield puddle, the short-term liquidity puddle. So if farm interest rates go up, what does that actually signal? Good question. If the Fed increases, what actually does that signal? So here are kind of my punchlines. They're not as different from last year's. I kind of thought they might be, actually. But I think one of the large risks to farmland is really the large risk to the economy. I want to say it again. I think one of the bigger farm risks is the risk to the bigger economy. In the 80s, the farm crisis was driven by farm interest rates. Didn't affect the rest of the economy all that much. Now if we have a change that's radical, if we exchange the size of the Fed's balance sheet really rapidly, that's an economy-wide problem. That's not just a farmland problem. I don't think it's likely to be sudden or unwieldy. And if you think about just the number of signals in a row from the Fed Open Market Committee meeting, and ever since Yellen has come in, the statements are, we're debating the process for continuing, considering, beginning to think about the time for suggesting a timeline for the future potential for considering easing our, So at some point, the idea has been translated to the signals getting closer and closer. We expect yields to be propped up at some point. The Fed is also running an enormous reverse repo market, so it's actually hard for them to raise. You take actions that historically would have raised short-term rates, and they're less effective now. But more importantly, what does it do to the 10-year spot on the yield curve in that previous picture? I don't think much. I don't think it affects farm mortgage interest rates all that much, and I think it's an economy-wide event. Number two, significant changes in crop insurance programs. I think this is somewhat unlikely to be fundamental, but as you've seen this year, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Why do you go after crop insurance? Because it's the biggest title. Why do we vilify Monsanto when it's GMOs? Because they're the biggest and have the most. Should we be yelling at other companies? I don't know. But the point about crop insurance is it's getting increasing numbers of targets on it from both sides. So I think we'll debate the size of subsidy needed to get participation, but I don't think we'll get a reversal of the programs in total. There's a lot of pressure right now to try to remove policies that have harvest price options embedded in them. I think there may be a pricing question there, but it's not a bad policy design issue. The third one, global slowdown in income growth, China and its proxies for the rest of the world. If we simply haven't gotten that right, if the FAO report on 9 billion people by 2050, and if the caloric curve somehow shifts, if we all become vegetarians, even if we have a lot of money, that kind of movement I think is unlikely, but would change the caloric. You notice I didn't include RFS. RFS changes in the US would not be as significant as they once would be because the rest of the world has very similar standards now. So we're going to put about the same amount of liquefied fuels through our gas tanks almost no matter what happens. That one is not as big of a deal to me anymore. So what's really going to happen in the next year? My guess is additional 5 to 10% reductions in cash rents. That won't translate to a 5 to 10% reduction in farmland values, though. Those are the top end. Some of the bottom ones are going up, and the share rental arrangements move around. Movements should be toward more flex cash, if you want my editorial. We have looked at, for a long time, the inner quartile range of actual sales. In other words, we throw away the top quarter, throw away the bottom quarter. Look at what's left in the middle, and that's a very standard, very good way to look at farmland values that are not influenced by selling 5 acres to the corner gas station or settling an estate that's been open in the family for 20 years. So that's a pretty good measure of real farmland values. Those have been much more steady than the popular press reports seem to say. And I think those are still trending down a bit. I won't be surprised to see another. That was a great answer. My answer would have been 3% would have been in my guess. Could be zero, could be up a little. But I don't see this major, major move backwards. World market adjustments to more normal stocks because we're going to figure out how to adjust the animal side, the human side, and the liquefied fuel sides all in, more in sync going forward. And I think debt levels can actually become a little more efficient. I think this it's sort of reminding people that the institutional investors are out there and are adding leverage underneath their properties is actually a healthy thing for a market. It's happened in a lot of other sectors through time. We don't have only startups doing tech anymore. You have real investments. You don't have only startups. And so the similar analogy for the US agriculture seems to be playing out. I don't think there's going to be this big drop on the market of acres, and in fact, we're kind of seeing the opposite. There haven't been a lot of sales and a lot of no sales, but less land actually listed, less auctions actually scheduled. And the argument about the aging population is interesting because people will point out that the average age of land owners is increasing, but it's hard to say the average age of operators is increasing as quickly. Moreover, we've all been getting older about 1 year per year for a long time. So it's difficult to find empirically why this causes a change in how much land is actually sold. It's a complicated argument. It seems to be easy to make, but it's like me saying Christmas cards cause Christmas. I observed it. It happens every year. I get Christmas cards, and then Christmas happens. I don't think the aging argument holds as much water as some people like to say. The big data issues, I think, do really matter, though, and in particular for selecting and identifying portfolios of holdings that make a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of promise. International diversification for anybody who's worried about currency risk issues. We heard some great comments earlier, good lucid explanation of what happened when we had things that led to strengthening US currency. One great way of diversifying your currency risk is to hold things that are denominated in multiple currencies. Most of us consume in US dollars though, so it may not make as much sense individually. But if you look at the pension funds from around the world, they're all looking around the world. Buying opportunities during readjustments, that's a pretty standard, not a very high-risk comment, I recognize. But I think that does mean that we're going to continue the financialization. I think it's going to continue to move and kind of help keep the markets fairly stable. Sophisticated buying kind of algorithms and insight have been evolving. I think equity or indexing vehicles are really positive. If I could come up with a way of publishing the value of farmland without actually having to sell or buy farmland, that'd be a great thing. If it created an index like Case-Shiller that you could trade against, and you said, you know, I'm worried about my farmland value going down, but I don't want to sell my farm. I'll short the index for a year, resettle. Next year, I have the same value. That'd be a great advance in the market. People get a little worried about it at first because it threatens some idealized versions of thought about ownership, but it'd be a great vehicle to have, an index for farmland. I think we're going to keep going toward more accurate understanding of long-term commodity value, commodity prices. Come to our IFAS meetings, and Daryl Good will much more accurately than I ever can tell you what he thinks the long-term value of corn and soybeans are. And he's generally always right, or enough people follow him that it's self-fulfilling. I don't know. But I think crop insurance toward that end and the production rationalization is really good, because crop insurance resets its spring price based on the futures price every year. So that tie-in is really critical to maintain. I'm not in favor of establishing permanent higher projected prices, for example. I think it should be market-based. Helps reduce risk without affecting income as much. A water policy I've kind of skipped over a couple of times in slides, but I think it's not so much water usage or availability. It's the reaction to creating policies that don't rationally guide appropriate usage of policy that's a bigger concern. I really worry about Southern California more about that than how much water there is. Punchline, final one, farmland remains a really solid investment on a risk-adjusted basis. If you remember both sides of that, it's a really reasonably positive thing to be in. So I could have started the day by saying, how many of you think farmland values will go down? Several of you would have said, your hands would have gone up. I would have said, how many of you want to buy farmland? A lot of you will put your hands up. And so rationalizing this market and coming to grips with the factors that are affecting both sides of that equation are a risk-adjusted basis relative to other things you can invest in. Farmland has some other advantages for holdings when it's also used to create your income. I don't need to go over those with you, but I think on a long-term basis, it's still a very solid investment. Thank you. So if I can paraphrase the question, I'll create, you tell me if this is an acceptable version of the same question. Does the fact that we're not on a gold standard mean as much as it used to? And do we need to worry about the currency value relative to some standard like gold? Is that close enough? No, it's irrelevant. So on a world basis, that actually is very difficult to make the argument for anymore. We don't store in any meaningful way. Russia has the biggest stockpile of gold relative to the currency value. I think I have that right. Not positive, but I think it's actually true still. And it's very easy to decouple. You don't have to go to a fiat currency model for trade to still work. And you have things popping up at the margin like Bitcoin that make it really hard to argue that the gold standard creates anything other than another index of a single local value of one commodity. We could have a corn index, right? Just like we have a gold index. I actually have, I didn't bring it, but I put the gold. Gold is actually one of the assets you can build those same triangle maps in one of our utilities, and it's really hilarious because it just doesn't follow monetary policy like the pundits would suggest it might. So I understand the argument historically for creating some centralized store of value against which you could always settle currency, right? So if you had to, you'd take a dollar and exchange it for the amount of gold, then you have a real asset, something whose value you could exchange later for whatever the new denomination of currency was. We convert dollars to real or pesos or something and have 1,000 to 1 or 1 to 1,000. The economy has gotten to the point where we can exchange across currencies enough that that's not the only single agreed to store of value. So I think it's not, it doesn't seem to me to be as strong of an argument as it was in 79, sort of pre-Bretton Woods kind of era.
You've been listening to Bruce Sherrick from the Center for Farmland Research here on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois. You may find his presentation to the Farm Assets Conference that was made on the 24th day of November 2015 on the willag.org website. That's willag.org. There, in fact, you'll find all of our agricultural programming, from the pre-opening market report to the closing market report and everything in between. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.